Good afternoon, I'm Alain Brunet, and the title of my talk is Post-Traumatic Stress Prevention Using the Internet. Another 9/11, it's just a matter of time before another 9/11 will happen. We don't want that. We've been talking a lot about prevention, and in the area of traumatic stress, we know that there are three types of prevention: primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. Primary prevention involves preventing a traumatic event from occurring. This is not something that we're very good at as psychologists and as healthcare professionals. Traumatic events happen, they've happened before, and they will happen in the future. We have learned a number of things from them, and I think that the most pragmatic approach consists in trying to mitigate the impact of traumatic events. And like many of us, in the aftermath of 9/11, I was struck by a number of things. And I also, as a researcher, as a clinician, I was thinking to myself, how could we mitigate the impact of such events? What could we do? And to paraphrase what Dr. Spiegel was saying, we feel so helpless. And I felt so helpless as I was watching those images. I was really stunned, and you know, in French there's a good word for this speechless horror. It's called effroi. I was really stunned. So what have we learned from events like 9/11? Well, those are really basic facts for most of you, but they're basic, but they're important. First of all, we know that those events are pathogenic. They will elicit lots of PTSD, but also lots of other disorders like depression, substance abuse, other anxiety disorders. And in fact, if we lump all the trauma-related disorders together, trauma-related disorders, from an epidemiological point of view, are the number one cause of psychopathology. So this is a huge public health problem in our society. And I would posit that it's grossly underestimated and under-recognized, even amongst mental health professionals. What happens in the aftermath of such events? Well, there are massive requests for help and for help and for information. And when I say massive, I really mean massive. Tens of thousands of people looking for information, feeling anxious, wondering, do I have PTSD? Does my significant other have PTSD? My child, my wife? What is PTSD? What is a traumatic event? Have I been traumatized? And so on. And there's a lot of confusing information also, which is typically distributed at that time. We also know that mental health professionals during those times work there are very limited resources, and there's a huge demand. So the system, all of a sudden, the system jams. The system jams, and very often, disorganization prevails. On top of that, there are lots of helpers out there who need a crash course on PTSD. They are willing to help GPs, mental health professionals, first-line responders. So how do we give them quick training with easy-to-use assessment tools? No disclosure of conflict of interest, by the way. Well, let me return to that in a few seconds. Those of you who don't know so much about the field of PTSD, we define PTSD with two elements. First of all, there needs to be a life threat, either to the self or to others, and this must be accompanied by a peritraumatic response of fear, helplessness, or horror. We also know that events such as 9/11 create a number of what Janice used to call near miss versus remote miss. So a small minority of people will really be in the eye of the tornado, if you like, or in the eye of the... Well, a small number of people will be directly touched, and a very large number of people will be only moderately touched. Okay, so we have really two very different kind of populations here. PTSD involves a triad of symptoms, which includes intrusive symptoms, avoidance symptoms, and increased arousal. Now, there's an interesting way to remember this triad of symptoms. When the patient goes to the psychiatrist, what does he complain about? He complains about intrusive symptoms. What was my joke? Avoidance, intrusive. Oh yes. So what does the patient complain about? Intrusive symptoms, right? Nightmares and so on, blah blah blah. What does the wife complain about? Sleep, arousal problems, being bumped and being strangled in bed and everything. And what does the psychiatrist complain about? Avoidance symptoms, because the patient is not working. So, this is my not-so-good trick to remember this triad of symptoms. Anyhow, traumatic events represent a public health problem, and in fact, a recent survey in Canada concluded that 76% of Canadians report one or more trauma exposure in their lifetime, and similar figures have been found in the U.S. 800,000 Canadians currently suffer from PTSD, and certainly millions in the U.S., and significant others often feel very helpless in dealing with their significant others. With the trauma-exposed individual. Let's look at resources. In Canada, we have 5 psychologists per 1,000 inhabitants. For psychiatrists, we have 12 for 100,000 inhabitants. How many of those are members of the ISTSS? Perhaps 24 or so. So, how many of those really have a good knowledge about PTSD? Probably not that many. We've also known for a long time now in the field of psychology that most individuals have the potential to return to homeostasis after a crisis if they are provided with a little bit of help. And that comes from crisis theory. And if you recall, after a massive traumatic event, there are lots of a small number of near miss and a large number of remote miss. So we're really dealing with a very large group with a fairly moderate to low trauma exposure. So it makes perfect sense to use a public health approach based in part on some of the tenets of crisis theory to try to intervene at a larger level. We also know from epidemiological studies that the conditional risk for developing PTSD, considering that one is being exposed, is 9.2. This means that almost 92% of the others return to some homeostasis. So it's not something that comes out of the blue, it's something that really makes a lot of sense. Still, 9% of affected individuals is too much. And we as a field, as a group of researchers, still have a lot to learn, and we've got to become better at early interventions and at prevention. Because we're not, I would rate ourselves with probably a C right now. So what do we have to offer? Well, we have interesting tested psychotherapies that work fairly well, either to prevent, well, mostly to treat, but we've got also some interesting data showing that early CBT can prevent the development of PTSD, or in some case ASD, acute stress disorder. But what is the take-home message here is that virtually all of those approaches include elements of psychoeducation at their core. And I think that another way of putting it is, Joe Ruzek once told me, we're providing a map for people as to what they are likely to go through, not what they will go through, but what they are likely to go through. You're not going crazy. And that's very reassuring, that's very soothing. So education is an important component of PTSD, of treating PTSD and even preventing the development of PTSD. And large-scale psychosocial interventions are well-suited to disseminate this type of information. So, this being said, the question becomes, can we foster resilience and mitigate the impact of traumatic events using a public health approach, considering that traumatic events will occur in the future either on an individual or a collective, larger collective scale? What can we do to mitigate the impact of those events? And more specifically, what can we do in this internet age? And why use the internet? Well, the internet is particularly good at repeating a message over and over and over and over. I was very intrigued by the talk yesterday about virtual reality. But there's one thing that I like about 2D internet is the automated elements that one can find in internet as we know it right now. And I think that automation in a circumstance like this is something crucial and very, very useful and very important. I wouldn't want to have to pull all the bells and whistles of my website and interact with someone who's on that website. I want the website to run by itself and to be able to disseminate a message to the widest population as possible. Another reason why the internet it could be useful in that situation, a lot of people have pointed to that already, but a lot of people are nowadays seeking health information on the internet. And just as an aside, if I don't know if you know about the Anxiety Disorder Association website, 5 million visits per month. This is, to me, stunning. 87% have experienced a traumatic event, which is very congruent with what we find in the general population. And 38% of them have PTSD. Those figures are really stunning to me. And I don't think one can find a better reason of going on the internet and trying to talk to these people. In a recent review, we looked at all the uses of the internet in mental health, and we came up with 6 broad categories of how the internet can be used in mental health. And the first one is knowledge transfer. There's a lot which can be achieved. A lot of sites disseminate information, and we classified those sites under knowledge transfer. There are also sites that provide online triage or diagnosis. And I put diagnosis under quote unquote, because obviously it's not considered a formal diagnosis. Then there are sites that do e-therapy more and more. You also find virtual communities, and several speakers have alluded to that already, the value of social support and of sharing, discussing, talking, ventilating. And 2 other elements include teaching or training, as well as conducting research with the internet. So we tried to devise a site. We were perhaps a little bit ambitious. We tried to devise a site which would do 4 of those 6 things, and they're outlined in yellow. But more simply said, the general aim of InfoTrauma, we wanted to give people the experience as if they were meeting a psychologist who would answer all of their questions about trauma. We wanted something very simple that would answer questions like, what is trauma? Where can I get help? How can I take care of myself in the meantime until I receive more formal help? And also the site includes another section where a mental health professional can find training material. This is probably the first version that we developed of InfoTrauma. I think the first one on the left-hand side looks kind of nerdy. I'm happy we didn't select that one. What you will also notice is that there are three frames, 1, 2, 3, because we figured that we were really talking to three broad populations: trauma-exposed individuals, their significant others, and mental health professionals. And we figured if we could create a path for each of those individuals or each of those groups, if we could create a path which consists of the most logical, which provides information in the most logical way for them, then we would probably have, we would have achieved something interesting. So in a nutshell, this is what each module of InfoTrauma is trying to accomplish. So first of all, if we look at the victim's needs, they need psychoeducation. Many of them will want to do a self-test. If they do a self-test and they realize that they may have PTSD, they will be looking for clinical resources, but not clinical resources that are thousands of miles away. They want local clinical resources. And they also want tips as to how to manage their clinical symptoms. If we look at the significant others or the general public, well, I put the blog there, but the blog can really be used by anybody, really. But we created vignettes, clinical vignettes, that may resemble someone they know. And we figured if we could present them a kind of clinical vignette which resembles someone they know, they could read that, and then they could read the advice and such and such. Plus, we also gave them a list of do's and don'ts as to how to help trauma-exposed individuals. In terms of the professional, we felt that there were two approaches. The approach which is, I need to know everything yesterday, and so it's the crash course approach. So here's a few questionnaires, here's how to interpret them, here's a leaflet you can hand to your patients, your clients, whatever, Here are a number of tools that you can use right now with the trauma-exposed patient, which is in your desk in front of you. So that's, we called it the emergency toolkit, toolbox. And then we had the other toolbox, which is a more formal and time-consuming training, which involves learning something which is very similar to the CAPS. So you learn about the symptoms, the signs and symptoms of PTSD, and this is a formal training which is sanctioned by McGill University and which has recently been funded by the Ministry of Health in Quebec. Very soon, in 2010, we will be training 3,000 mental health professionals with this module, and they will all receive a certification from McGill University. A little bit like if you were going for Red Cross, training on cardiac, resuscitation. So this is what it looks like. So this is my avatar. He doesn't wear glasses. I still wonder why, but anyway. So this is the psychologist's office, and please note that the clock is actually showing the correct time. So on the top you have a line on the top which involves learn about trauma, which is for the general public, experience trauma, which is for trauma exposed individuals, and professional resources and training. So let's go first into the learn about trauma module.
In this module, basic information on trauma is presented in order to help you gain a better understanding of post-traumatic stress, examples of different kinds of symptoms, and the impact they may have on an individual's behavior are illustrated through various case studies.
The site is in French and in English. It is bilingual. And so on the right-hand side, there's a list of frequently asked questions. There's a number of stories. We have about 12 different case stories. Children, rape trauma, disaster, and so on. We're trying to cover a very broad range of traumatic experiences. And then we have a kind of vignette explaining what happened to this person. And the third section is advice. Because significant others frequently look for advice, and we've been conducting research with Dr. Ruzek, notably, and we've been very interested in the impact of negative social support, and we've been using the social constraint scale as well. And what we've found is that if we can prevent significant others from giving negative social support, we've already accomplished so much. You know, it's not so much about the positive support that you don't give, but it's really about preventing that those negative comments, those negative, hurtful comments. And so we're giving a few advice and some, you know, basic stuff also, but which may be very useful. Coming back to second module. By the way, we're not online right now. Just wanted to tell you. We've organized, we've installed a server in the computer because we don't like glitches.
In this module, you can find information that will be of assistance to you by clicking on the corresponding menu. You can also complete a test which will help you to assess whether you have post-traumatic stress disorder.
So let's pretend I have post-traumatic stress disorder and I want to do the test.
I will help you to determine if you are exposed to one or more traumatic events during the course of your life and will then verify if you have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
Okay, so let's say that I have experienced a traumatic event and I was directly exposed and it was a car accident. Now we're assessing peritraumatic responses. Let's say that I felt totally helpless.
You have undergone a traumatic event. We see large individual differences with respect to the impact of these events. Symptoms can become accentuated or can change with time. We'll now examine the impact that this event currently has on your life.
So, you have experienced the following traumatic event, a serious road accident. When did this occur? It occurred in the past month. And now I'm directed to the IESR. And then I need to fill the 22 questions. So Christophe will be filling the 22 questions. By the way, I want to emphasize that this is a teamwork and that this site is very much the work of Christophe Herbert, who will also be presenting about the educational component of that site tomorrow. So I'm filling out the 22 items of the ISR, which do not exactly map those of the DSM-4, but close enough. And why am I filling those out? Because if I fill out the 22 items, then I will be provided with a preliminary result of my questionnaire. I submit it.
The majority of people who have symptoms similar to yours suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. We highly advise you to consult a mental health professional as soon as possible for an evaluation in order to help reduce the length and intensity of your symptoms.
Please note that we haven't told the person that he or she had PTSD. We say most people who score like you have PTSD. I think that's very important. And then you can download your results, and it creates a PDF which you can bring to your GP or your psychologist or your psychiatrist, and you can say, hey, I took a test the other day and it said that I probably have PTSD, and I'm coming to consult with you to get a confirmation of that. And on that PDF, it says that the person has been exposed to a serious road accident. The event posed a threat to their physical integrity. They felt totally helpless. And most people who score in that range have PTSD. And then you can see in red the scores that people had selected. So this is a very concrete way of providing immediate feedback to people on the internet as to whether they suffer from, they should be worried, should they be concerned about their situation or not. And then after that, they might say, well, perhaps I should look for help, and then they will go on where to get help. And in that section, they can find help in 35 different countries. Okay, in Kenya, we only have one address. And then once they've found out where they can get help, there's another section which is called taking care of yourself. And then there's a number of advice which maps, which overlaps in part with what we've seen in the other section, because it's pretty much the same advice. So we figured that that's one way of giving real immediate advice, information, and help in a time of disorganization, in a time where a lot of information, confusing information or contradictory information may be given. Then we have a third section, which is professional resources.
In this section, you can download a variety of professional tools for a fee. You may also access online training to help you in your professional practice.
And so, as I was mentioning earlier, we have an emergency triage toolkit, a rapid diagnosis toolkit, we have a small guide for trauma victims, and an online training for a fee. I won't go into all the details because you can access it online. Okay, back to the PowerPoint session. We've received some really good feedback so far from people who have been on the site. It's almost 100% positive, and the one I was the most happy about was this one. Now I know what I've been suffering from has a name and that it can be treated. I think this really covers a number of comments that we've obtained, that we've gotten. We've also asked the help of a a public relations firm to launch the site just a couple of weeks ago. And this was really helpful because in 2008 we launched it without any advertisement, and we didn't really want any publicity at that time because we had a beta version, and we had roughly 2,000 visits per week. The minute that we got a news release about the site, we went to 4,000 visits per week. The site has been consulted so far in 31 countries, and 15,000 pages are viewed each week. And the average time spent on the site is almost 5 minutes. This may seem low to you, but in fact, it's quite high compared to other sites. I also want to emphasize that it's in setting up such a website, it's very important that the seriousness of the information be attested. 42% of internet sites on trauma include erroneous or misleading information, according to a recent paper. And so that's why we asked to obtain the UNCODE certification. And there was someone who presented the UNCODE at the beginning of this conference. And the UNCODE has a number of elements that you need to comply with. And I think this is tremendously important. Let's talk a little bit about future directions. Well, I already mentioned that we will soon be training 3,000 Quebec first-line responders with the online training module. But also as a researcher, we are interested in trying to assess the usefulness of a site like this. And this conference has been really very stimulating for us. We've been trying to find ideas as to how we could assess the usefulness of the site. And I would certainly welcome ideas from this room. So far, the two ideas that we've had was that we could correlate improvement scores for PTSD symptoms with the time spent in each of the site's module, provided that the website visitors agree to take part into some kind of survey. Another, and provided that they do take part in this survey, we also were thinking that we could use quizzes with them to know whether they have learned anything, and then try to see correlate that with change score in terms of PTSD symptoms, as an attempt to try to better understand which component of the website are the most helpful in decreasing PTSD symptoms. Another element which is really important, which we do not always talk about in research, is how can you ensure that the site will be financially viable? This is tremendously important because those sites cost a lot to develop, and generally speaking, they are free. And most researchers are used to asking for grants, but there are very few grants that can be obtained to develop such websites. We've been reverting to a number of different strategies. We've obtained grants, but we've also obtained private funding from the Douglas Foundation here. We obtained some government funds. We plan on making a little bit of money with the training. And in the future, perhaps we could even include a little bit of advertisement on the site. If you have other ideas or suggestions, they certainly are welcome. And finally, the site has won an award in 2008 at the UCDA Design Competition. It won an award of excellence. I will stop here and take a few questions. Yes.
Thank you. I have a way for you to make money.
Good.
You should take what you've done here. I have a way. I think I'm using the right hands.
I have a way for you to make money. Take what you've done here on the website. turn it into an iPhone app, sell it for 99 cents. The website continues to be free. Apple allows you to keep 75% of whatever is made. So what you've done here is brilliant. It's interactive. It's fun. I don't know if you have an iPhone, but if you want, you can check mine out, and I can show you how the apps work. They get cleared within a week. They get on the App Store. You get to keep 75% of whatever they make. So, I mean, Apple makes a killing for sure, but you get 75 cents of every one. You have 100,000 people download this little thing. It's only 99 cents, and yeah, it looks really interesting, and you guys are, you know, real clinicians. It's not some joke thing. It's serious and for real. The website stays free. You get 100,000 people download it, you got enough money to pay somebody to update things. Another 100,000 download. You know, you put additions to it. You release version 2.0 on the iPhone. Away you go. Website stays free, but you make a big whack of cash.
Interesting.
The code's free. Like, the source code for designing applications is free, and it's no more complicated than what somebody would have had to do to put together that website.
Interesting.
Yeah. No
I
charge.
Have to discuss that with my colleague, Christophe, who's a big Apple fan. He's even lent me his computer. So, yes, David.
I don't want to make work, but I have another suggestion for potentially making money. That is, you know, all municipalities have to do disaster planning. And it seems to me that you have a tool that could be very useful, could be mobilized immediately for assessing mental health problems and helping to deal with them in the aftermath of a trauma. So one could also approach municipalities, you know, counties, states, that have to have some plan in the event of a large-scale disaster, and have them say, okay, you know, we've developed this, you know, can you provide some support and plans for using it in the event of a disaster. Now, the one bit of work is it would be useful to do what you've done for acute stress disorder, because that would be much more salient in the immediate aftermath of a trauma. Mm-hmm. But I think it's got great potential for immediate disaster response.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just two comments. I think it's important to point out how prudent you were about putting the information and being very careful not to, when people self-screen, that they do not get a message that they have PTSD, because quite often I think that can be misleading, and then people actually get the wrong information. And the other comment is about the stress prevention, post-traumatic stress prevention strategy. I think training a large number of professional providers, as you said, you're planning, is probably the best way to have the expertise at hand once there is a major disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I think that is an excellent strategy, actually, to do that beforehand.
Yeah.
Of course, the emergency triage is helpful for the people mm-hmm. who found themselves mm-hmm. in that case, but that.
In this room, we have Mr. Emergency Measures, Claude Martel, who has been coordinating that in the province of Quebec for the last 13 years or 15 years, I don't know exactly. We've been working, we've been collaborating together, and we intend on collaborating even more closely in the future. And it's with him that we developed the contract to train 3,000 people. Can you imagine training 3,000 first-line responders face-to-face, the cost that it would involve? With this internet interface, the cost is going to be minimal, and it's going to be very effective, we predict.
Hi, yes. My comment regarding the presentation is that the InfoTrauma website is that from what I see, it could also be useful for an epidemiological study by gathering information from the people who log into the website to to get information about it, and also for long-term longitudinal studies. Is that in plans?
Yes and no. We are gathering hundreds of IESR every week and probably every day. Right now, everything is anonymous. But what we would like to do is, once people have filled out the IESR, we would like to ask them if they would agree to participate in a small research project. And then our hope, especially based on what some of other people here have done, would be to create a large database, perhaps not an epidemiological database, because as you know, there are many issues with creating a representative sample here, but certainly a large convenient sample allowing us to examine correlational factors over time as to what predicts recovery and so on, like Dr. Spiegel was mentioning. So yes, it is in the plans, in the works, but it's not going to be an epidemiological study. Other thoughts? Other comments? Thank you for your attention. Okay, so we've got a few minutes on our hands, but I suggest we just take a little break and enjoy the sun until the next speaker at 4:25.